What goes for Greenland and Gaza also goes for Ukraine, with the third anniversary of Russia's all-out invasion approaching and Kyiv on the back foot on the battlefield. Allies scrambling to figure out the art of the deal power plays of a U.S. president they thought they already knew. Do you placate or push back when you're dealing with Donald Trump? Ukraine's president's been showing transactional flair by vaunting his country's rare minerals in exchange for protection from Putin. Zelensky, who now openly contemplates what Trump wants, direct negotiations with Moscow, will review terms and conditions. And on the day that France has delivered its first Mirage jets to Kyiv, the degree of volatility the coming weeks and months may bring for Ukraine, for Europe that's still divided over whether to wean itself off its reliance on the United States for its own security, and for the broader former Soviet space. Today in the France 24 debate, Ukraine's options, and with us from Kyiv, France 24 correspondent Gulliver Cragg. Good to see you.
Good evening.
From the Ukrainian capital, she's a former Kyiv city councillor, Olena Halushka, co-founder of the civil society advocacy group, the International Center for Ukrainian Victory. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
From Odessa, we welcome back Hannah Shaless, Security Studies Program Director at the Ukrainian PRISM Think Tank. Good to see you.
Good evening.
Political philosopher Volodymyr Yermolenko is president of the Ukraine branch of the International Writers Association, the Pen Club.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If you're on the go, by the way, you can listen. That's right, listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, before the bargaining table, the battlefield, Gulliver Cragg, you're just back from the front line in eastern Ukraine.
In Donetsk region, in Donbass, the ever-shrinking Ukrainian held part of that where people are getting more and more nervous, understandably, because the Russians, although their advance has slowed this month compared to the last few months of 2024, are closing in on three key goals, which are the towns of Pokrovsk, Turetsk, and Chasiv Yar. I was speaking to those involved in the defense of Chasiv Yar. Particularly, I was struck by these two guys who were foot soldiers, infantry. They'd come out of the town on foot once their position became indefensible. And, you know, they said themselves that there really were moments where they did not think they were going to get out of there alive. It's an absolute hellhole in Chasiv Yar. Ruins, like we've seen in Bakhmut, perhaps even worse. But the fight is still going on. There are some, though I think an ever-diminishing number of Ukrainian servicemen who believe that there is still a chance to hold on to Chasiv Yar, or at least to inflict as many losses on the Russians as possible before finally giving it up, because the loss of these two hilltop towns, Chasiv Yar and Turetsk, will be very, very serious, have very serious implications for the rest of the Ukrainian-held part of Donetsk region, and the taking of Pokrovsk, this key junction, similarly. So anyway, you can take a look now at the report that I made, shot on Monday. Tuesday, sorry.
The technician exits the dugout, sets the drone down, and swiftly heads back to safety underground, where the pilot is already in action.
We might be delivering ammo to our guys, or we might be dropping bombs to humble the enemy's movement. Right now, we are just training, but in a real situation, what we would see is the ruins of Chasiv Yar. That's what it looks like now.
Hiding amid these ruins are both Ukrainian and Russian soldiers. The battle has reached the center of this strategic hilltop town. After weeks in this hellscape, Matvey and Alexander got orders a few days ago to leave on foot.
I am so glad we managed to make it out there safe and sound, against all odds.
I kept telling you to stop all this, we won't get out nonsense.
It's thanks to the fog. There was a really thick fog, which meant the drones weren't flying. There was nothing left of our position to defend. A couple more days, and it'd have destroyed us.
The Russians, they say, have two key advantages, numbers and ruthlessness.
They first send what we call the deficient contingent, drug addicts and alcoholics, and they're going to their deaths. They're going to die and they know it, and they cannot go back. They reveal our positions and clear the way for the regular troops, who then follow them in.
Yet Ukraine has managed to hold on to Chasiv Yar for over 8 months of a determined Russian onslaught.
For a long time, this canal here was a barrier to the enemy's progress. But then, they started to use the pipes in the canal as tunnels. For now, they've pushed us out of the northern part of town. And they are taking huge losses every day as they try to progress further.
They clearly feel the prize is worth the price.
Controlling high ground allows you to control all the logistical processes, from physical movement to radio communication.
For what's left of Ukrainian-held Donbass, the implications of losing Chasiv Yar are dire.
All these towns are downhill compared to Chasiv Yar, which means the enemy's artillery will be able to hit them.
Meanwhile, life goes on. Loudspeakers here proudly announced that last year, 572 babies were born in this district.
Hanna Shalesh, let me just ask the obvious question. Do you hold the line?
Yes, or at least we don't see that significant as some of the media predicted in the end of the last year. Advances of the Russian armed forces. We are definitely lost some of the territories. The fighting on the east.
To interrupt, my question is, if you're Ukrainian and you're fighting and you're incurring those heavy losses around Chasiv Yar, do you stay or do you retreat?
No, Ukraine is not retreating because it is the existential war. We just don't have other options. We don't have other countries to move anywhere. So the war is always flexible is not a proper word, but it is always in the war. You are gaining, you are losing. So there are times when we are counteroffensive. We have the good news in some of the parts. There are bad times, and the last few months were not good at some of the directions of the front line. But at the same time, Ukraine is not retreating. Ukraine is trying to keep all their territories and to return to the territories where it is possible. Even more, just today in all the Russian social networks, you can read that Ukrainian armed forces started again the advancing at the Russian territory. And even that, we don't want to occupy it, but we need it so the Russia would feel that it can be at their territory as well. They are not just those who can take without any punishment the territories of other countries. So we have something for exchange.
Volodymyr Yarmolenko, your reaction when watching that report?
Look, I've been to these places many times. So for your listeners, just to understand that I'm just a few days in Paris and actually I live in Kyiv and I travel a lot to those areas. And I think those when you've seen the town, Gulliver will probably correct me, but it's probably Druzhkivka or Konstantinivka. I think it's Druzhkivka. I know these places and I know how tragic it is for people who are living there to understand that Chasiv Yar is destroyed. And what is very, very tragic is that this agglomeration of towns, which you probably know, Kramatorsk, Slovyansk, Konstantinivka, are really under attack. But I agree with Hanna. If you look broader into the situation, well, Russians have taken no big major Ukrainian city, not a regional center. The only regional city they have taken since 3 years was Kherson, and they left it. So we should also see it in the perspective. Look, I've been to places which are now occupied by the Russians, like to the south, villages like you probably heard in the news, Veliki Novosilki. I've been there 1 year ago, and the Russians were 10 kilometers away. Yes, they are advancing, but 10 kilometers per year. So we also need to put it into perspective, and we need to understand that the big battle is in our minds, and what Russians are trying to persuade us is that we are losing this war, which is not correct because, yes, we are holding and we are defending against very, very strong enemy.
But you heard Hanna saying they're taking territory in Russia, perhaps as a bargaining chip later, right?
But look, the reality of this war is that it's very important to make a blitzkrieg. And if you look at the territories that Russians occupied, majority of them was taken very, very quickly in the first weeks of this big war. So Ukrainians are actually doing the same in Kursk. And look, half year have passed since the start of the Ukrainian operation in Kursk regions in Russia. Russians cannot do anything about it. So it's, interestingly enough, tragically enough, it's also a war of maneuvers and not only the positional war.
We're approaching, Alina Halushka, the third anniversary. Your thoughts as we head forward. You heard in that report those two soldiers say that it was thanks to the fog that they got out.
Well, as we are approaching the third anniversary of the full-scale war, we have to be absolutely mindful that this will be 11th anniversary of the Russian aggression against Ukraine. Because Russia attacked Ukraine first in 2014 when they occupied Crimea and parts of Donetsk and Luhansk regions. And as my colleagues very well said, yes, we do have certain hardships on the battlefield, but we also have to be mindful on the successes and achievements. And if you take a look, for example, as Ukrainians are presently exploiting long-range weapons, and I specifically mean long-range drones, attacking Russian military bases deeply into the occupied regions and deeply into the territory of Russia, or oil refineries, or gas processing plants. You know, all of this infrastructure, which helps Russian logistics, which helps Russian war machine, I think that's a very big step forward, which brings us into the question, what would be the battlefield situation today if Ukraine was granted all of those necessary capabilities, long-range weapons, fighter jets? By the way, we are very grateful to France for receiving French fighter jets today. But if those weapons arrived a year ago, 2 years ago, I assume the situation on the battlefield would be very different today. So that's why we have to understand that the cost of inaction and the cost of delay is huge, and it is being paid by the Ukrainian army.
And there could be...
But isn't it too late?
Gulliver Craig.
I mean, I fully agree with you that if the West had given Ukraine the weapons that it was asking for and that to a large extent they actually promised and they didn't deliver them on time for the counteroffensive in 2023, the situation would be very, very different today. But saying that is not the same as saying that it's still possible to achieve the results that it would have been possible to achieve in early 2023 or mid-2023 had the West provided more weapons. The situation today is very different. Ukraine, apart from not having a realistic perspective of getting significantly larger amounts of weaponry from Western allies, because we know who is president of the United States now, Ukraine has fewer people who are willing to fight and use those weapons. And so I'm not sure that, you know, we can very much regret that it didn't happen in 2023, but that's not the same as believing that it can happen now, I'm afraid.
Alina Halushka? Alina Halushka?
Yes, I think that it is very important to assess the situation from those resources that are available for us today, from the manpower resources, and we have to be mindful of how to best plan our operations and ensure that we are achieving maximum results with the available resources.
All right. What is for sure is that there's fresh uncertainty with a U.S. president who campaigns on the promise of a sit down on day one. It didn't happen between Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. However, we heard on Tuesday in an interview with British journalist Piers Morgan, the Ukrainian president for the first time contemplating a face-to-face negotiation with his Russian counterpart, albeit with conditions.
Let's be honest. If our allies believe we must move to the diplomatic track, and I believe we're ready to move to the diplomatic track, there must be the United States of America, Europe, Ukraine, and Russia. Isn't that already a compromise? We will talk to Putin.
All right, two parts in that clip we just heard, Hannah Schelest. First of all, do you agree that that Ukraine is, quote, ready for the diplomatic track?
Ukraine was ready to the diplomatic track since day one, because I just always try to remind to my counterparts that in the end of the February, beginning of the March 2022, Ukraine was at the negotiation table with Russia, first in Belarus and then in Istanbul. The question is that what Russians brought there, it was the act of capitulation, not the act of negotiations. Not speaking about the previous 11 years, where we had the Minsk format and we had negotiations with Russians with the French and German involvement as the mediators. And we know that for Russia, it was always just the way to either make Ukraine to surrender something. Previously, it was not the full surrender, just about the eastern territories. Now it was de facto the decomplishing of the dissembling of the state, because those requirements that Russia presented in March 2022, they haven't changed till February 2025, if they even became worse. Because, for example, just one of the Russian demands, they would like to control not just all territories they are currently occupying, but totally the administrative territories of Kherson, Zaporizhia regions. The region that they never controlled in full, for example, even when they had in the beginning of the war bigger control. Or they would like to prohibit Ukraine any trainings with the foreign countries, or to have just 50,000 of the forces, or to give a special permission for the Russian church. And we know that the Russian church was the weapon of this war as well.
And Hannah, when you hear Volodymyr Zelensky say, okay, let's have a sit down, let's have the United States, but as well Europe at the table alongside Ukraine and Russia. We know Donald Trump doesn't like to have multilateral meetings. Is that, does he say that knowing that that proposition would be dead in the water with the current occupant of the White House?
No, it's not coming because of this belief. It is coming because our current war is definitely a lot about Ukraine, but it is much bigger. Putin is already in war with Europe. He is openly stating it. He is not hiding it, the same as all his opinion makers. So that's why Europe also should be present there. It is about their security. It is about their future the same way. And we know that Polish, Baltics, Nordic, they are constantly saying that they insist that they should be at the negotiation table. The same with Brits. Just today we heard it from the minister who've been in Kyiv. So as this war is not just a Russian-Ukrainian war, it is much bigger. It broken a lot of the conventions, agreements, treaties that cover the whole Europe. So that means that Europeans should have their voice during the negotiations.
And that British minister we see him on screen there is the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy. He went to Kyiv on Wednesday. His Ukrainian counterpart kind of seemed to be addressing Washington, not London, when he repeated his country's promise that we've heard for several months now, that there'd be lucrative deals on strategic raw materials that include rare minerals, that and much more. Let's listen.
I want to highlight that our circle of common interests and mutually beneficial cooperation is not limited to just strategic resources. There's a huge potential, especially after the cessation of Russia gas transit through Ukraine, in this purchase of LNG gas from the US. As you know, Ukraine has extremely significant underground gas storages. And here, we also have points for mutually beneficial cooperation.
Volodymyr Yermolenko, there we hear Andrei Zabija speaking the language of Donald Trump.
Well, I think it's a language of interest. I think it's a language, it's a pragmatic language.
Would he have used those words if the Biden administration were there or the Harris administration?
Well, it's clear that Ukraine has been using the words of the language of values for all this time, and we keep on using this language of values. But I do think that one of the weaker points in our communication was that we were kind of not very well using the words, the language of interest and the language of the pragmatic language. We see that the world is becoming much more cynical. We see that from the Trump administration, we see that from other parts of the world. Well, Ukraine has to survive. We are struggling for our survival. So it's normal that we are trying also to speak different types of languages. It doesn't mean that when we are speaking the language of interest, that we don't no longer speak the language of values. And let me just follow up with what Hanna was saying. I think it's a very important point. I mean, Europe is so sleepy in the question of this war, of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I mean, let's ask a question. What will happen if Ukraine falls? What will happen if you have Russia, which is very, very big power now militarily, which is using forces from the occupied territories, and which will look around and will attack other European states? Is it a plausible scenario? If you think about Russian geopolitics, if you think about Russian political thinking, of course it's a plausible scenario. So let me ask you a question. What kind of army in Europe is able to protect itself against this possible Russian invasion? Is it a Polish army? Is it a German army? Is it a French army? Are they together? Well, it certainly will be a challenge. And, of course, it's in Europe's interest.
It's the
now.
U.S. Army is what you're saying.
Sorry?
It's the U.S. Army.
No, it's the Ukrainian army. It's the Ukrainian army.
Sorry, when it comes to, I thought you were talking about military support.
The point is that if Ukraine loses and Russia decides to move further, the point that Ukrainians very often make, I believe this is the point Volodymyr Yermolenko is making, that Europe's best chance of defending itself is to help the Ukrainians who've got a huge and experienced army right now, rather than their own small armies, leaving it up to them and taking their chances.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for Gulliver, for my friend to help me to raise this point. But I mean, it's a question of the European security. And now, when the politics of the United States is unclear, I'm repeating this all the time in Berlin, in Paris, and other European capitals. Europe is in a situation of the geopolitical solitude and geostrategic solitude and in military and security solitude. So it's in its interest to invest its all efforts, its all thinking, its all support to defend Europe in Ukraine.
Can I ask you, Volodymyr, what kind of response are you getting? Do you think Europeans really perceive this threat?
Well, my perception is that no. And my perception is that on the political level... Sorry?
No, is what you're saying.
Yes, I'm thinking my perception here in Paris, in Berlin and other capitals is that mostly Europeans do not perceive this threat and do not see the threat coming. And therefore, we see the kind of... political statements are better now than they were like in 2014. But when we see how the military industries are reacting, are they reacting? Is there more progress in supply chains? Is there more progress in better cooperation of the military sectors between Ukraine and European Union? Is there a progress towards bringing Europe on a kind of a faster track of helping Ukraine? I don't see that happening.
It's happening. There's this deal when it comes to ammunition. There's the French defense budget, which has been made higher. The German budget, defense budget, has even been doubled.
Exactly. But if you talk, for example, to even German military companies, you will see that, they are not capable of producing so many weapons as, for example, is needed for today's war. And what is very important thing is that technologically, the war is very different. You cannot really fight in this war only with good tanks, only with good artillery. It's increasingly a drone war, and technologically, changes are on the front line every several months. And the question is, what technology is behind on the both sides of the front line? And the answer, the sad answer is, it's not European technology, it's Chinese technology. So who is winning this war technologically is probably China. And I think that Europe should wake up in this and understand that, this is also a technological question. Who will be more advanced in the 21st century?
Elena Halushka, are we fixating too much on Washington, listening to Volodymyr Yermolenko? Are we worrying too much about whether he will or won't Donald Trump continue to support Ukraine?
Well, I think that, first of all, I fully agree with what my colleague said. And there is a strong call and sense of urgency. And my understanding is at this point, we still do not know what will be Donald Trump's policy towards Ukraine, towards this war. And that's why Europe should definitely ramp up production, should develop and invest in their defense industries, and make sure that in the worst case scenario, Europe is capable of supporting Ukraine and supporting and defending itself. Because as Volodymyr rightly said, that this is the war of technologies. And just today, I have read in news that North Korean ballistic missiles are right now much more precious and much more effective precision comparing to what they've been half a year ago. Because for the first time in the battlefield, they were deployed in the end of 2023. Then they were pulled out of the battlefield for a couple of months. North Koreans upgraded technologies given on how they tried them on the battlefield and, you know, improved and upgraded. And unfortunately, we are not seeing this coming from our Western partners, because you've said that we have this important Czech ammunition initiative, and we are very grateful that European Union finally managed to pull together and deliver a bit more than 1 million artillery shells for Ukraine. But in the meantime, during the same period of time, North Korea managed to deliver to Russia up to 5 million artillery shells. And the question which, you know, appears here is that how come that one small North Korea is capable of supporting Russia much faster and in a larger scale than the entire, you know, European Union, which is much larger, which is wealthier. And,
okay, because North Korea is not a democracy. It doesn't worry about the welfare of its people. It devotes all its resources to building weapons and supplying them to Russia because it's in its absolute vital interest to supply Russia in order to be in this alliance with Russia and support and get Russian support. And in European countries, they have elections. And if the European countries decide to start spending huge amounts of money on defense, that will mean they'll be spending less on healthcare and other things that the people want. And there are populist, some of them pro-Russian parties waiting in the wings in all these European countries who believe that Russia's not a threat and who will say, you know, and who will get themselves elected. They can only do so much because they're democracies.
Gulliver,
the
there is a counter-argument.
The threat.
There is a counter-argument, if I may. You're absolutely okay, right please. When you're describing the reality of the situation. We understand it
if
very
Russia
well.
Can go, if Vladimir Putin decides to go all in on a wartime economy, that's what happens.
Yeah, exactly. We understand it very well. We also are a democracy. We understand the democratic procedures and changes of power very well. But there is a big question, what does democracy at war means and how it should react somewhat differently, not substantially differently, but somewhat differently. Because if we follow this argument up until the point, we can say, okay, but Russia is not a democracy. Russia is a militarized authoritarian state, and therefore it can pour all the money to its attacking power. And what will happen if it, for example, decides to attack one of the European Union member states or one of the NATO member states? What will happen if it starts to attack the Baltics, Finland or Poland or any other countries? So I can tell you what will happen. Russians will make a blitzkrieg during 1 week when the Europeans and NATO countries will, you know, discuss and consult whether to activate the Article 5. And then the problem is that, as I said already, the acquisitions during this blitzkrieg will be such that it will be very difficult to regain this territory. And NATO and EU will be in a situation when parts of its territory will be already occupied. So it's better that democracies and the citizens in democracies think now how to prepare yourself to this scenario, which is very plausible.
Hannah Shaless, the future may be now, because when we see Donald Trump threatening to take over the Panama Canal, threatening Greenland, saying he might empty Gaza of Palestinians unilaterally. Isn't that sending a signal that the values that Volodymyr was just describing have already been eroded, and that's sending the message that it's okay for Putin to do the same thing?
It's never been okay. And if one person are sending such messages, it doesn't mean that other millions around
him. Is that what's happening? Am I exaggerating?
You're not exaggerating, but it is happening around one, two people. And as we already hear, even after the quite outspoken statements about Gaza, the team of Mr. Trump is already trying to unroll it back because they realize that it is not okay and that his emotional statements, it's not always are the same and equal to the policies of the United States or even the interests of the United States. And here, you know, with the values, it's always the question is how we are taught at school. Don't look at that bad guy. Look how you are acting. So that is the question. If Mr. Trump is acting like this, should Mr. Macron act like this? Should Mr. Starmer act like this? Should the King of Sweden act like this? And here, like, you know, to just add to your questions of the spending, just the last 2 days, it was the big security conference in Oslo. And it was very good statements from the ministries of defense, of the heads of the general staff of the Nordic countries. They said, yes, a lot of countries are increasing their spending, but let's see for what they are spending this. Because many of them spent for the new uniform or for the increase of military pensions. They did it for these, not for the modernization of their armed forces. So here, I would disagree partially with the Gulliver, because he is speaking about the population. Yes, we should care about the population, but we also should make the audit where we are really spending all those money and increasing the military budget that being done within the NATO.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying that, you know, whether we should or should not care about the population, that's another matter. It's just the functioning of democracy. If governments spend too much money on defense, they will get voted out, and the governments that will come in to replace them will be worse from the point of view of what Ukraine would like to see.
Gulliver, again,
I'm saying that it's not about spending more. It is about how we spend those money that we already have. The question is now, it's not just to take 5% of the budget. The question is how we are spending those two that we allocated. And most of the military are really doubting that it is effective in many of the Western European countries. Nordic, at least, seeing that a lot of the spending in Germany are very ineffective.
But you're not saying that 2% would be enough if only we spent it more cleverly.
Gulliver, can I jump in?
Yeah, you could improve efficiency a bit.
There are two counterarguments to your point. The first is, if Russia is not stopped here in Ukraine, there will be a bigger war in Europe, and then everything will be spent. Well, you want it or not, but everything will be spent on defense. Otherwise, there will be a threat to European democracies much bigger than even those problems that democracies have now. So the military spending will increase at the expense of the healthcare, at the expense of schooling, education, and all other good things. The second counterpoint, and I think here Hanna is correct. I would put it in a different way. We recently went to Sumy region in the north of Ukraine, and we spoke to soldiers who are downing the Russian drones, the Shahed Russian-Iranian drones, and they showed us the fragment of these drones. And if you look at the drone, you understand how cheap it is, to produce. It's very deadly. It can kill people. It can destroy houses, but it's very cheap. So it's not, in order to fight these drones, you need to have cheaper weapons as well, because you cannot spend too much expensive weapons. And the debate around spending and security spending is sometimes a debate about money. It's not only should be a debate about money. It's a debate about how efficiently we spend it. It's not necessarily that if we built a very expensive tank, that we'll be more successful on the front line.
So you need the right weapons for this kind of war, and you need the right intelligence.
And you need to right quantity, because Russia is about quantity, and that's a very important thing.
Olena Halushka, Kyiv is very far away from Washington. But right now, there's a lot of turbulence there. This week, we saw the Central Intelligence Agency offer its agents a voluntary severance pay if they wanted it, if they didn't feel like signing on to the remit they're going to have going forward. And many have accepted, apparently. The turbulence in Washington, how does it affect you?
Well, of course, Ukraine is presently defending itself from the existential fight. So the turbulence in Washington directly affects our affairs. But I would like to add, you know, to this discussion, which my colleagues had regarding the money, the resources, there actually are money that can be spent for the Ukrainian self-defense and Ukrainian reconstruction and rebuilding of our energy infrastructure, even today, even without sending the bill for the Western taxpayers' money. And here I mean the assets of the Russian Central Bank, $300 billion that were frozen in the first days of the full-scale war in G7 countries. If those money are confiscated and sent into the bank as the reserve for Ukraine, we would be much less dependent on the political turbulences, because this is not only about Washington. The elections are coming in Germany. We are very closely following the political dynamics in France, Romanian presidential elections, and so on and so forth. If we go for establishment of the secure reserve of the money, and according to the international lawyers, this confiscation would be a lawful countermeasure. And this money can be set as an offset payment for the reparations. Russia has already inflicted at Ukraine almost $500 billion damages. And we are speaking about $300 billion. And this money already started working for Ukraine, because the windfall profits on the frozen Russian assets in 2024 were already taken away and invested into Ukrainian defense. And even the French Ministry of Defense received 300 million euros that were invested into procurements of the Caesar howitzers, shells, and missiles. So I think that confiscation is done, this can be a mutually beneficial.
So let me ask you about this, Elena, because in the world's currency is the U.S. dollar. In the closing days of his administration, Joe Biden tightening the sanctions on those so-called ghost ships that try under the radar, literally, to transport Russian oil. Do you see the Trump administration continuing those sanctions?
We still do not know what will be the policy of President Trump, because in one of the plans that was developed by the envoy, Keith Kellogg, there was the position that the sanctions might be partially relieved in order to incentivize Russia to sit at the negotiations table. But we think that we need to put the pressure that sanctions should be toughened, that this assets should be confiscated instead of being returned to Russia. And only by strength, Russia can be basically, you know, make to give up on their imperialistic ambitions, because they are reading the messages of weakness, and the sanctions relief would be perceived by them as such, as an incentive to move forward, to get more, to bully other partners into achieving much more. As Hannah said, you know, they never occupied Zaporizhia, but in their so-called peace initiative, they see Zaporizhia as the Russian city. It's very important to have the peace through strength, and this peace through strength would be impossible without real sanctions.
So, Hannah Schalist, which is the real Donald Trump, the one who appointed Keith Kellogg, who's a Russia hawk, pragmatist? He knows the situation well. Or the Donald Trump who has nominated to be his head of all intelligence services, Tulsi Gabbard, who is a pro-Putin former congresswoman?
Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and his unpredictability and this cocktail of different views is what is the real Donald Trump, with whom we need to work and to live the next 4 years. That's something that all of us being prepared. And we need to understand how he is evaluating his candidates. It's not the same way as we, because she openly said that, yes, Russia is guilty in this war at her hearings, and she is seen as the ex-military or current even military, that the person with the experience. So Donald Trump sees her as a strong candidate, and he doesn't see those conflicts of interest as we saw them. And here is very important to understand that he always would like to have these two different opinions on the difficult issues, because then he has the maneuver for bargaining even inside of his team, and he can just decide what will be more beneficial for him or for the United States at the very particular moment.
When you were reporting in the east of Ukraine, Gulliver Craig, what were people telling you how they saw the turmoil in Washington?
Well, people there weren't talking about the turmoil in Washington, really. They do talk, you know, I'm struck there on my recent trips there by the seemingly diverse opinions that there are among soldiers. You know, you meet a lot who say, we've got to keep fighting, we've got to hold the line, and you meet others who say, we're exhausted, we need a break, we can't do it anymore, even if it's freezing the conflict. Vladimir, I don't know if you go probably more often than I do, I don't know if you have the same impression that there are some soldiers who really, really, really just think there's got to be a break, and there are others who think that that would be disastrous.
Absolutely, Gulliver. I think that we cannot really say, like, the general view among Ukrainian soldiers, what do they think about it? It depends really on a unit. It depends on a particular soldier. Now, of course, everybody is exhausted, but it doesn't mean that they are going to retreat. That doesn't mean they're going to give up. And we should also understand that, well, there are more and more reports that Ukrainian army is exhausted, but it's only half of the truth. The other half of the truth is that I think all the Ukrainian society, like, accepted this fatigue and exhaustion as a kind of a fatality. Well, this is our reality, but we need to continue to defend ourselves despite this.
Continue to defend despite it. We will, of course, continue this discussion in the days and weeks to come. What will be the, just one last question, Vladimir, you think the make or break moment that shows what Donald Trump's decided in his head?
Well, I think the key story is about security guarantees, and they should be physical, not only just paper. We understand that paperwork, we had already a Budapest memorandum, it doesn't really protect us. So the security guarantees means to be something physical, like how we really protect ourselves against any possible Russian continuation of the war or a new war. We need to understand that ceasefire, temporary ceasefire, is not a solution. We already went through this in 2014, 2015. Everybody is asking, what is Ukrainian victory? What is European victory here? My answer is very clear, is to make Russia incapable of continuing wars against Ukraine, against Europe, against other countries.
We'll have to leave it there. Volodymyr Yermolenko, I want to thank you. I want to thank Hanna Shalesz for being with us from Odessa, Olena Halushka, and Gulliver Craig in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.